All right, can everyone hear me? All right, I think some of the familiar faces from 1 hour back. I hope you're all doing well. Yeah, you're going to see me for another 45 minutes here. So for those who don't know me, I'm Ravi Shankar. I'm a cloud solution architect with CloudFlex Consulting. And today, in this session, I'm going to talk about the Microsoft Hybrid Cloud Platform. So basically, how do we bridge the gap between your on-premise data center and the Azure or other public clouds, right? So let me start with what we have in store for today. I'll be quickly going over the Azure stack on what it is, how it looks like, the architecture of it. Then I'll quickly go over the software-defined compute, networking, and storage portion of Windows Server 2016. All right, so this is the Microsoft's hybrid cloud platform scenario. On this end of the spectrum, we have Windows Server and 2016 that cater for on-premises workloads. In the middle, on the other side, we have Azure public cloud services that cater for cloud related services, right? If you see in the middle, we have some of the services like Microsoft Azure Stack, Operations Management Suite, that basically bridge the gap between on-premise and the public cloud. So they can work both on on-premise side as well as on the public cloud side, these services. Today's focus, we are going to talk about the Azure Stack. Now, anybody who had seen the news about Azure Stack release on January 29th, right? So might have seen the architecture as well. Basically, Azure Stack is a product, a stripped down version of Azure public cloud components that are adopted for your own data center. Right, it has components starting with compute, storage, networking, etc. Then you have the additional services, core services. You have the management platform or the framework, Azure Resource Manager. And on top of it, you have the Azure portal and the dev tools. Now, all these form the core layer on top of which you run different services like IaaS, PaaS, and various other networking and storage services. Today, however, I'm not going to go too deep into Azure Stack because today it's all about Windows Server 2016 release. So our focus is going to be entirely on these three components, compute, storage, and networking features that are offered by Windows Server 2016. All right, so what is a software-defined data center? Put simply, it is made up of three different components: software-defined compute, software-defined networking, and software-defined storage. These are the three pillars on which a completely software-defined data center stands on. Now, there are more to a software-defined data center or an infrastructure, like removing the limits of physical configuration. Basically, you should not be going and configuring your switch every time you're onboarding a new VLAN or a new tenant. So that should not be happening. Every time you are provisioning a virtual machine, you should not be going and creating a LAN and presenting it to it. It is expected to happen automatically in an automated, orchestrated fashion. So you go click a button, just like you're doing it in Azure public cloud, and it is expected to provision itself automatically. And it is supposed to be platform agnostic, so you should be able to host Windows Server, Linux servers, Linux virtual machines, and various other platforms. And you should be able to centrally configure it using policies and applications. All right, so this is what a software-defined data center technically looks like. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pick a couple of topics in each of these software-defined fields, starting with software-defined computing. All right, so some of the topics have already been touched upon. I will basically try to go over them on a different angle as much as I can. All right, the first thing I would like to show is the nano server. Again, you might have seen the demo during the demo fest and in a couple of other sessions as well. So what I want to do is to show you the practical approach of how easy it is to create and manage the nano servers. So the first is, let's take a quick look at how we started where we are now with nano servers, right? When we started out at Windows or Windows NT servers, basically Microsoft introduced the concept of roles and features, okay? So by default, all the roles and features introduced were installed. You just needed to configure them. But out of the box, they were all installed for you. With Windows Server 2008 and 2008 R2, Microsoft introduced the installation option of Server Core. The concept being that even though you are shipping all the server roles and features binaries, you get the option of not installing all of them out of the box. So Server Core installation will not install all the features and roles out of the box, as well as in some cases, it will not even ship with the code that is required to install those roles and features. All right? The same concept carried over to 2012 and 2012 R2, but here the difference is instead of considering the Server Core and full server as a two different entities, Microsoft actually started with the Server Core build. And on top of it, they introduced or they layered the minimal server interface, basically your interface without desktop experience pack. And then on top of it, it came the GUI shell, the desktop interface pack, okay? So these are the different scenarios. Now, in each of these, right, the server core and the minimal server interface or GUI, each had its own advantages and disadvantages. Why do we even need such a setup? It's pretty simple, right? When I ship a operating system with all the features and roles installed in it by default, one of the biggest challenges for IT administrator is to go and update them on a regular basis. Whatever update Microsoft releases, every fortnight or every month or a quarterly cycle, you need to go and update it whether or not you're using the role in the server itself. So that caused a problem, unnecessary overhead for administrators. So what Microsoft did is to come up with the Server Core option where you choose which roles and features to install. Now, that does not mean that the binaries for the roles themselves are not present on the server. The server operating system still shipped with the roles and services binary. So if a malicious administrator who caught hold of the admin privileges, they can install whatever roles they want, or if there is a zero-day vulnerability in a feature, they can literally exploit it and gain control of the server. So basically, that made the server bigger, slower, and error-prone, as well as vulnerable. So enter the concept of nano server. It is called as just enough operating system. So with nano server, what Microsoft did was basically, let's strip down everything that is to do with the operating system, right? You take away roles, features, drivers that ship. Everybody knows that OEM drivers that are certified to work ship along with the operating system, right? So that is one of the reasons why with each release, the operating system gets bigger and bigger and bigger with backward compatibility, forward compatibility, whatever reasons. So what Microsoft did is strip down everything. They took the Windows kernel and they put enough components so that you can take that set up and put it on a hardware, and it will run as an operating system for you. That's it. There is nothing else other than the kernel and few other components for you to interact with. Now, that is not a viable option. You cannot simply just run an operating system that does not serve a purpose. So what Microsoft also did was to give you an option of choosing what are all the roles and features that you want. You get to pick, and you get to add it to the server. So this is a process called as image creation. So when you have decided that, hey, OK, so I'm going to go with Nano Server, and I want a Hyper-V Nano Server. So it may not look like a big deal for an SMB organization that has like maybe 3 or 5 servers to go for Nano Servers. Okay, maybe like it really does not serve my purpose. In fact, it is causing me overhead or learning curve that is creating me problems for my administrators. But imagine a hosting service provider or a large enterprise where they have hundreds of servers. Or in the case of Microsoft data center or any other data centers, large data centers where they have thousands of servers. Imagine the amount of power that they can save by reducing the footprint and, as a result of it, reducing the power consumed by those servers, right? So that is where the Nano Server's greatness becomes very visible. So it reduces the overhead. It reduces the resources consumed. It reduces the attack surface. Basically, the more components you add to an operating system, the more attack surface or more methods of, you know, finding vulnerabilities and infecting it, virus, malware, etc., happens, right? So the smaller you keep, the more harder it is. That is why Nano Server is called as one of the secure, or if not the most secure, Windows server ever. Okay, so let me talk about a little bit about the image creation process, how it does. I'll show it to you in a moment, how we create a Nano Server image. I don't want to go too deep into what happens, how it happens, etc. I can show you in a couple of minutes. You can get going and you can create your own image. So we start with the base Nano Server package that ships with the Windows Server 2016. And then you decide that I want Hyper-V server role. I want file services. I want failover clustering for Hyper-V cluster. I want OEM drivers for my NIC cards and specialized motherboard components and whatnot and whatnot. So you choose those components. And during the process of creating the image, you specify, I need those components. And you're not specifying it to a overly complicated script or a program that you need to sit and type for hours and hours. It's just a single line command that you run. If you are even allergic to that single line command, right, Microsoft comes up with the GUI, where you can basically, you know, say, run a script, and it'll pop up with a GUI, where you can mention what are all the roles I want, what are all the options that I want, and then do it. It'll take about 10 minutes to create that image, and the overall image with all the features included would come about less than a gig. So you take that, you put it in a physical box, or you put it in a virtual machine, and you can start consuming the different roles. What happens by this approach is you have narrowed it down to only the specific set of features that you want. If you don't want a Hyper-V failover cluster, you remove those features and put just the file server so that when the next update cycle comes up, your administrator needs to only update the patches that are released for the file services and not for Hyper-V and 100 other components. Right? So basically, this reduces your IT operations overhead. Not only that, it actually increases your uptime so that your chances of getting it wrong because that patch that was released by Microsoft interacted with some other component that is not intended because of which the failure happened. It is a very well-known story, right? Basically, a patch released by Microsoft had an unintended consequence, and it ended up crashing the server. right? So let me show you how it looks like to create a, let me go over these. So before I switch, I just want to show you the list of server roles that you can install and the features that you can install. For example, you can install or you can add to the image Hyper-V SOFS, which is basically the file server, clustering, IIS. Let's say you want to just use the server for web hosting. You can use IIS, or you can use it only for DNS server role. Imagine having a virtual machine with nano server that only runs DNS. Even that is a big resource-saving proposition, right? And then you can have .NET Core, Defender. You can pick and choose which roles you want. You can also choose the drivers that you want to install. And if you want to monitor or manage them remotely, you can install the virtual machine manager and OEM agents as part of image creation. All right? So let me quickly show you what I mean by creating a nano server. I hope everyone can see the screen. Okay. Not this. All right. So what I want to do is I'm going to go through, walk through the process of creating an actual Windows Server image. It is just a few-step process that anyone can do. All right. So the first process that I'm going to start with, which I did not prepare for, I'm going to do it anyway, is basically give me a moment. So here I have the RTM release of Windows Server ISO that I downloaded from web, okay? The first process is to mount this ISO. So I'm going to double click and mount it. And as you can see, it has a folder called Nano Server. If you go inside that, it will have a couple of folders. The first folder of interest is Nano Server Image Generator. Basically, it's a bunch of scripts that help you generate the image that you want. I will come to that later. The folder, other folder of interest is the packages folder. Now, these are the packages that are available for you to include as part of image creation. All right? So what we have done so far is mounted the ISO. I'm going to copy this folder to my C drive. And as you can see, it is already there. All right? So I've simply copied everything from the ISO to my C drive with the same folder name. And I have created a folder called temp where I can create the resultant nano server image. Now, so far simple. Can follow me? Yeah? All right. It is going to get even simpler. I'm just going to switch to my lab environment, but the whole process is exactly the same. So what I'm doing is to create, help me facilitate the creation of nano server image, you might have seen the folder called nano server in C drive. That had the PowerShell module. So see this PowerShell module here? This module will basically provide me option to have three more commandlets for creating the nano server image. So what I'm doing is basically on a clear screen, I'm going to import this module. So I have switched to the path of C. And I have mentioned where the PowerShell module is located using import-module. I'm going to run it. All right, let's see. All Okay? For some reason, it opened the file. Okay, so once I've imported the module, the next thing for me to do is run this image generation command. Now, remember I told you that we can add, pick and choose to add the server roles that we want? This is a single line command. All right? So what I'm doing is I'm calling the script. I'm saying which edition I want. In this case, I'm mentioning data center edition. I'm saying what is the deployment type. I can create it as a virtual machine image, or I can create it as an image that I want to put it in a physical server. So in this case, I'm saying I want to create a virtual machine image, which is guest. If I want to put it in a physical server, I would mention host in here. And then media path. So this is the nano server folder that I copied. It is asking me for the root folder where that folder is located. So I'm mentioning C drive. Base path is the path where all the files or the temporary files will be copied to when it is creating the image. So I have mentioned the base path as this one. And target path is basically where the finished image would be copied to. In my case, I have put it in D drive, nano, and so on and so on. Now, here's the trick. So it supports creating generation 1 or generation 2 image. If I want generation 2, the extension that I specify is VHDX. If I want generation 1, I specify simply as VHD. It's as simple as that. All right? And the next thing is, it is asking me for computer name. I can give any computer name. And then it is asking me for the domain name. Now, the important factor is, when running this command, I need to run it from a computer that is part of this domain. In my case, Lenovo Local. So this computer is part of that domain, so I'm OK with it. What it does is, this command queries the Active Directory, harvests a blob, and inserts it as an unattended XML file, so that when the nano server boots up, it automatically joins the domain. All right? And then here's the fun part. So I'm mentioning compute as one of my option that I want. Compute is basically a Hyper-V role. All right? Then I'm mentioning clustering, which is the failover cluster role. Then I'm mentioning storage, which is the SOFS role. And finally, I'm mentioning what is the maximum size to which my image file, the VHDX file, can grow to. Is it simple enough so far? Yeah? All I need to do is just run this command. It is going to ask me for the administrator password, which I could have included in the command itself if I wanted to. All right? I'm going to give a password. Now, this whole process takes about 10 minutes to complete. Basically, it'll create an image. It'll start inserting the packages one after the other. All right, so let it run. I'm not going to disturb this. I have a finished image already available with me. So in here, I have the finished image that is available for me. Hopefully, it is not used. All right. So this nano test image, as you can see, the finished size is about 534 MB. So what we are going to do is, we are going to do a fun little exercise. I'm going to copy this over, or let it be. I'm going to create a virtual machine. I'm going to leave it as default, generation 2. I'm going to give it 2 GB. And I can enable dynamic memory in it. I can make it connected, and I'm going to use an existing drive, and finish. Now, what I'm going to do is minimize this screen. I'm going to bring this console up, and I'm going to bring up a timer. All right? So I'm going to reset this, keep it here. Now, you all know how a nano server machine login screen looks like. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to start the clock. I'm going to start the virtual machine process. Let's see how long it takes for the whole process to run through. Now, what it is happening in the back end is, it is a sysprep image that is going through the image formation process. And if I had given the domain join process, it would go ahead and join the domain in the, hold on a second. My bad. Hold on. Okay, I'm resetting the clock. And I'm starting the process again. So it is going through the process of sysprep, and then if there are any roles that needs to be installed, it installs them. And if the domain join option was given, it joins the domain. And the moment you see a cursor right around here, that means that the process has been completed. And you will be presented with a login screen. And that's it. It took me about 30 seconds for the entire image process to complete. And I can simply give my username and password. I can type properly. Wow. All right, so what I'm doing is I'm logging into the server locally, and it should present me with what are the options that I have. And in this case, for this image, I have basically installed the Hyper-V role as well, and it is going to give me those features that I showed you during the DemoFest option. So the whole process takes about 20 to 25 minutes. Now, this might look like an inconvenience when you do it one-off, but when you do it for a physical server that is going to be there up and running in your infrastructure, this is a very minimal effort, and you would recover that 30 minutes that you invested in creating the image in the first week of maintaining the server. All right, so that's the nano server image creation, and I also wanted to show couple of other options. I'll close this. All right, so since I've covered the remote management in the DemoFest, I'm not going to go through it. Basically, you can use Server Manager for remotely managing or enabling the roles, etc. You can use Hyper-V Manager if the Hyper-V role is installed, Failover Cluster Manager if the Failover clustering is installed, and File Server Manager, basically Explorer to manage it, and obviously PowerShell using remote PowerShell remoting. All right? So the next topic is on the software-defined storage. Again, we have seen enough about this software-defined storage since morning, but I'm going to go through it one more time. So let me quickly go through what actual SAN is made of. Again, some of you might have heard this slide from myself in the previous session. But for those who did not, I'm going to quickly go over it. So basically, a classic SAN is made of a bunch of disks, which are managed by two or more controllers for high availability. These controllers provide features like thin provisioning, deduplication, high availability, and performance characteristics like storage tiering, etc. and then they are presented to other servers using connectivity adapters that provide FC fiber channel connectivity or iSCSI or various other types of connectivity. So this is how a traditional SAN looks like. Now enter Microsoft, how we can basically adopt this for the software world. So you start with a bunch of disks that are made of JBOD or just a bunch of disk enclosures where you put your commodity server hard drives and solid state drives. And then you connect those JBODs to two or more Windows servers, right? So these Windows servers act as your storage controller, providing similar feature like that of a SAN controller. Like, for example, deduplication, your thin provisioning, storage tiering, and mirroring or high availability features similar to RAID configuration. And then you make the storage available to other servers using Ethernet connectivity. Either it could be a simple 1G Ethernet or 10G, or it could be 10G over using RDMA, or it could be ROCE. It can be any type of network. And in traditional world, it supports SMB access. SMB, as you know, is not a block-based storage. You don't present a LUN to the target server, but rather you use a file share to present it. But you can essentially use iSCSI and other forms of storage presentation methods as well. So this feature was introduced in 2012 R2, where we used the JBOD. We started with JBOD enclosures with two Windows servers that formed as what we call a scale-out file server. Basically, these are nothing more than file server roles installed in two Windows 2012 R2 servers. And then from those scale-out file servers, we created storage pool. Basically, these, although the picture indicates one enclosure, these could be potentially two or three for redundancy. So all the two or three enclosures are presented as a single disk pool to both the servers by the operating system role, the scale-out file server role, from where we created what we call as storage spaces. In SAN parlance, it is called as LUNs. So we created storage spaces, and then from that storage spaces, to make it available to other servers, we created the file shares or scale-out file server role, using the scale-out file server role. And then that file share is accessed using SMB 3.0 protocol, which is basically a continuously available a file share. Unlike your traditional file share, which basically closes after a period of inactivity, these type of specialized file shares remain open all the time. And they are presented to the target Hyper-V servers, which access them through SMB protocol. Enter 2016. Now we have two options. Along with the traditional scale-out file server, where we basically started with a bunch of disks and whatnot, here we have what we call as converged architecture with storage spaces, or in short, converged storage. Basically, we start with a bunch of specialized servers, technically two or more, which have disks attached locally to them. We form a cluster, and that cluster basically allows you to pool the local disk into a one big enclosure, right? Once you pool these disks, you present the disk using the SMB storage fabric or your Ethernet connection to the target Hyper-V clusters. All right? The second scenario is what is called as hyperconverged. Now, this is what is all the rage at the moment, hyperconverged storage. Basically, what hyperconverged means is that you're combining storage and compute power into a single server so that the server can utilize the local storage itself as it is being presented from a SAN device. So again, we start with two or more servers that have local storage plus processing power in them. And then we create the storage pools. Basically, we are pooling all the disks together into one big pool. And out of this pool, we are creating LANs or storage spaces. Okay? And then from these storage spaces, the only way in which Microsoft or the Windows Server makes it available out of the box is through file shares, SMB file shares, as I said. But you can make it available through iSCSI targets as well as NFS roles as well. So you create, you add them as cluster shared volumes, and you create file shares, and you start hosting the virtual machines in those cluster shared volumes. So now you have storage and compute together that forms the hyperconverged use case model. All right, before I go on to the demo, or you know, anybody have any questions that you would like me to answer? Okay, so you can stop me if you have any questions. I'm going to quickly show one scenario that I did not show during the demo of the previous session, which is basically the hyperconverged. The previous session, I covered what we called as the hyperconverged storage or converged storage. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring back the switched on server up. I'm going to show you that it allows us to actually host Hyper-V role in them, which can be used for hosting virtual machines. So I'm going to go ahead and open the Hyper-V server role, hopefully if it is fast enough. Come on. Okay. One more time. Since I just restarted the other node, the server is going to be a little busy. So let me try the alternative method of connecting through this. Hyper-V Manager. Okay, while we are trying to bring this server up, I just wanted to quickly show you something that has been made available in 2016, what we call as nested virtualization, running a Hyper-V virtual machine inside of another virtual machine. Okay, so it's pretty simple. It's nothing complicated. What you do is basically you start with a PowerShell. So in my case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a get-virtual-machine, which is going to dump all the virtual machines that are in my laptop. I'm going to do a simple command. Okay. So for running this, enabling this Hyper-V, nested Hyper-V, you need to have the virtual machine shut down. Somebody would tell that you need to run it before switching it on for the first time, but that is not the case. You can switch off the virtual machine at any time, and you can enable this attribute, and you can basically enable the Hyper-V role inside of it. Now, the key is that in order to enable this feature, the chip or this processor in the physical device, in this case, my laptop, should support what is called as VTX, or virtualization extension feature. If it is not supported by your processor, unfortunately, you cannot enable it at the virtual machine level. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to enable it for Nano VM, and it's a simple command called expose virtualization extension. I'm going to give it as $true, and that's it. This would allow me to boot this virtual machine and enable the Hyper-V role inside of it. Okay, so it's as simple as that. You can go ahead and try it in your lab, or let's say you have a Azure, access to a physical box that does not have enough, privileges to it. You can ask your administrator to run and give the virtual machine to you with enough specs that you can install the Hyper-V role and start hosting the virtual machines. Okay, so now as you can see, I have enabled the Hyper-V role in this virtual machine, and I can simply go ahead and, by the way, this virtual machine is part of the Storage Spaces Direct cluster. So if I manage to host a virtual machine inside of this, that would basically complete the hyper-converged storage scenario. Okay, so I'm going to give a test. Not going to worry too much about this. I'm sorry, folks. The server has been really slow for some reason today. Okay, I'm going to just choose all defaults. I'm going to create operating system later. This is just to show you that I'm able to create a virtual machine that I can install operating system and host it on a virtual machine. All right. So let me get back to the last section of my slide, which is about software-defined networking. Now, one of the biggest investment that Microsoft made, hold on. One of the biggest investments that Microsoft made is in the area of software-defined networking, where basically in Windows Server 2016, they took all the components like software load balancer, data center firewall, and other appliances that were available, like virtual gateways, and they have shipped it with Windows Server 2016. So these features or these capabilities are actually tested in Azure data center. So if I switch over, you can see the different features that ship with Windows Server. Now, I have given just a quick overview of all these different features. Please, since I'm running out of time, I'm going to stop the session right here. Please go ahead and download the deck when it is published. And in the deck appendix section, you'll see the software-defined networking session that was conducted by one of the Microsoft program manager called Jason Messer, which elaborates how you set up the software-defined networking, starting with how many nodes you will have, you'll have the system center component installed in one node. Then you start creating the logical networks and so on and so on. Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to cover it today, so I'm going to wrap up my session with this. Anybody have any questions? All right, thank you. Thanks a lot for attending the session. I appreciate it.